Figuring out how to map out your retirement journey is one of the biggest challenges in the retirement industry, with the old statistic that only 6% of us will retire with what is considered enough. That is, to retire without our living standard that we enjoy while working being diminished. Now, we're clearly misreading the map, or we're not reading a map at all, or we're choosing the wrong routes or modes of transport here. South Africans need to contribute 17% of their income for 40 years to retire comfortably. That's on 75% of their final pensionable salary. It's a 75% replacement ratio, according to the 2019 Alexander Forbes MemberWatch survey. And the frightening reality from the 2019 MemberWatch analysis shows that the average replacement ratio at retirement is 26.2%. And that's assuming the member bought a with-profit annuity at retirement. So ask yourself if you could live on a quarter of your current income today. Well, to talk about what this year's survey reveals about one of the most important aspects of our financial lives and how COVID is impacting this, let's welcome our guests, Belinda Sullivan, Principal Consultant of Multinational Consulting and Best Practice at Alex Forbes, Andrew Davison, who's Head of Advice at Old Mutual Corporate Consultants, and Dave Crawford, Founder of Planning Retirement. Welcome all. Belinda, tell us a little bit more about the survey, which really has become the industry flag bearer and has been for some time now.
Thank you, Michael. The MemberWatch survey is a quantitative analysis of over a million members. It's the biggest membership sample across all retirement funds in South Africa. And what we're able to glean from the insights here is member behavior. So in other words, what are they doing with their benefits when they are leaving their retirement funds, either on exit? So are they preserving their benefits? What are they doing on retirement? Are they buying living annuities, life annuities? Or are they taking cash? But more importantly, what it helps us understand is what are the potential outcomes that members can achieve in the retirement fund based on the level of contributions that they're making, and you know what sort of terms they need in order to achieve favorable outcomes in retirement. So therefore, being able to design the products, to design solutions and services around helping them achieve those outcomes. We obviously have a few levers that impact those outcomes, which talks to contributions, their investments, expenses, as well as preservation being key, a key factor there.
Absolutely, and it's that old bugbear in the industry that when we're retrenched or when we change jobs, we South Africans tend to take that money and rather than preserve it, cash it out and I don't know, go and gamble or start a new business with it. But we're certainly not putting it back into our retirement pot. And that's why that number remains so dismally low. Just before we go into the reasons behind that 6% number, Belinda, what does 17% contribution of income mean in simple terms? How many years of pensionable salary does that actually equate to that you will need on the day that you retire to ensure that you can retire comfortably?
So, Michael, the 17% is actually the net or the net contribution that must be allocated towards retirement savings over a period of around 40 years. And based on that, to achieve the 75% replacement ratio or replacement of income, we're looking at around a multiple of 12.2 times your salary at retirement, your annual salary. So a significant amount, but it does give people something to measure against as to how far they're going with their plan.
Now, it's important to have that that figure in mind. The headline figure for me is still that only 6% of South Africans can retire with what is considered enough, and that is a 75% net replacement ratio of pensionable salary. And we'll talk about the difference between cost to company and pensionable salary in a short while. But at a headline level, it's been like this for a long time. And I'm going to go around the panel, but Belinda, perhaps you can kick us off. Why has this number remained so dismally low for so long, almost since we moved over from defined benefit to defined contribution funds all those years ago?
So I think also, first of all, Michael, the change from defined benefit to defined contribution, one of the key things that members took on was A, to take on the risk of poor investment performance over the duration of their time. Their savings were building up like a savings account. But the key problem here is when people move from one job to another, our stats show that only 8.8% of members are actually preserving their benefits. And one of the key issues here is that Either they consider their benefit too small to preserve at that time without considering the long-term implications, so losing out on the ability to earn interest on interest, so the compounding effect of that impact on their benefit over the long term. And I think overall, just making poor decisions for instant gratification now rather than considering a long-term plan and sticking with that plan to achieve a reasonable outcome.
Andrew, from your vantage point at Old Mutual, what are you seeing as some of the key reasons for the stickiness of that 6% number? The industry seems to talk about it year in, year out, but we're just not seeing any movement.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. It's unfortunate because, we've tried a lot of things as an industry. I think there's been a lot of education drives. There have been, an improvement, I think, in communication. We've got legislation that now requires things like default reservation to try to encourage people to leave their savings in the fund instead of taking it out and spending it, as you say, when they change jobs. And yet, none of these things seem to really shift that dial. So I think it's unfortunate, obviously, because 6% is a dismal number in terms of where South Africans get to when they get to that retirement phase. But I think there are a couple of other factors, that I don't think we've necessarily made allowances for the fact that we are living longer as well. So, people are living a much longer period past age 65, and yet the retirement age hasn't really shifted. So I think, there are so many different factors that have contributed to the fact that that number seems to just stay at 6%.
Dave, you've been in the industry for an extremely long time, without giving away too much here. But you haven't seen much change in your time as well, and I think you've been particularly vocal about some of the reasons why. What, in your experience, is the reason behind this dismally low number just remaining at that 6% for so long?
I'd just like to make a point that in 1977, when I joined the industry, and I'd already had something of a career in agriculture, so perhaps that's a qualification, I don't know. I was told at a course I attended at Old Mutual in September of that year that 5%, their figures indicated that about 5% of retirement fund members would retire in comfort. They didn't specify too much, but sure. So 40, however many years later, we're on 6%. Which I think to some extent says that the change from defined benefit to defined contribution wasn't as significant as it's often said to be with those kind of figures. I took their money and went, regardless. I don't know if you know, some of the bigger organizations, you have to work there for 10 years before you're allowed to get your own contributions plus 2% or something like that back. So in many ways, the environment militated against it as well. But I want to go to something that interests me. Einstein, I think it was, said, if you do the same thing repeatedly, expecting a different solution, you are going to, that's a sign of insanity. And when I look at the level of member education and the way it is done, you realize that it's in many places, look, there are notable exceptions, but the fact is, it's treated as a kind of mantra. Yes, we're going to do member education. We're going to hand out 50-page booklets. We're going to do this. We're going to do that. There's no real that I've been able to discover, and I talked to most of the big players as well. Nobody's really created a sort of institution of educating the member. ASISA is doing the people who work in the industry, but the members themselves, where education takes a role, and I've been fortunate enough to have worked for a couple of very big organizations where we actually do have a look at this sort of thing. We found that preservation has risen dramatically because people are aware, and I'll talk about the measure later, but once they start taking responsibility for it themselves, because the great demon for me about defined benefit was that people felt they had no responsibility. The fund would provide, no matter what they did, if you hung around long enough, everything would work out. And of course, when defined contribution pitched up without education of any real significance at the time of the changeover, they just kept on going and assuming that everything would work out the same. But what was not drawn to their attention was the reduction in many cases of total contribution.
And Dave, from your experience, you host a lot of seminars and you ask questions of the delegates you send out.
Yeah.
And say, well, what are your concerns? How many of them know the difference between remuneration and pensionable salary, for example? Because this becomes a very important distinction when you're trying to work out what you're trying to get 75% of at the end of the day.
Some companies, yes, they do make it very clear. But most of them, you can ask a group of people in the knowledge that they're on a cost of company package, and they won't know whether they're on a salary plus or a cost of company arrangement. They just don't know. Within the same company, you'll get 20% saying, oh, yes, they're on cost of company. And the others will say, well, actually, they think it must be salary plus because that's what their payslip says, is salary. So, yes, there's a lot of ignorance about that.
But Belinda, from your survey, what have you found when it comes to the difference between the two and how important it is ultimately to outcomes at the end of the day?
So, Michael, it's really critical because aside from knowing whether you have a basic plus salary or a total cost of company benefit, what we find is that those members who have total cost of company are only contributing on a certain percentage of that package that they're used to living on. So I might have 100,000 Rand monthly income, but actually the pensionable amount might only be 50,000 Rand a month, which means that I'm saving my 17% on the 50,000, thinking that I'm doing a fantastic job. I'm at the max, I'm following what the stats say, but coming back to it, there's actually this huge gap in terms of what I'm used to living on and the income that I have as a whole versus what I'm really contributing towards. So it is a major impact on members in terms of those outcomes. So when we look at the percentage of salary, the 17%, we're looking at pensionable salary, basically the salary that is advised to us that the employer is contributing on. And even if we look at a basic plus environment, I might be used to getting 50,000, but in fact, I have a car allowance, I have other allowances that are added on top of that, that also then benefit me. And I'm not making provisions, say, to take on my healthcare expenses. I'm not making to take on future car repayments, because it's always just been part of my life. And I'm thinking from an employer perspective, and I think it was Andrew that said that, Dave, that in terms of the DB environment, the assumption was that I'm taken care of, I don't really need to worry. And I think to some degree, people think that if I'm putting that amount away based on that salary, I'm okay. I'm doing the right things. And the big crunch time comes to when we send out a replacement ratio statement saying, well, you're only able to replace 50% of your pensionable salary. We haven't actually looked at the fact that the shortfall could even be even greater than what we're reflecting. And I think that's what needs to be taken into account when people are being counseled, especially on an individual basis. And as Andrew highlighted, you know, the default regulations make provision for retirement benefit counseling. They make provision to make preservation easier for members so you can preserve your benefits in the fund. But in that discussion, to understand what the broader implications are, and I think that then comes back to how key getting advice is throughout your working lifetime, throughout your journey is, because if you can start saving and understand that difference between what is pensionable, what am I saving on relative to, you know, what am I used to living on as a whole package? I think, you know, we can limit that gap. But from an industry perspective, it is hard because sometimes we don't know what those add-ons are that actually, you know, make someone's life completely different compared to the element that we see when we receive contributions and
but
measure that.
That's Belinda, why we South Africans have this penchant not to preserve when we change jobs or when we retrenched. And I think it's particularly important now because this is backward looking in terms of the data. It hasn't gone through what's happening now with COVID. And we know there are a great deal of retrenchments. There's lots of retrenchment going on at the moment. So the last thing we want to see in years to come is that everyone who is retrenched now decided not to preserve. And you've used some predictive analytic tools in the survey to really identify five key levers or factors that affect the level of preservation. What are the keys here and how can we start to improve levels of preservation within the industry?
So first of all, I think just coming back to the fact that these are pre-COVID stats and making sure that the retirement benefit counseling is a key factor for members who are faced with retrenchment and giving them the opportunity to either consider, you know, what am I doing with my employer package? What am I doing with my retrenchment package from the retirement fund? And knowing that there's an opportunity to then keep that benefit preserved in the fund. So delaying spending that money into the future. And that will then help in terms of long-term savings and a long-term plan as well. Going forward, if the member has spent that money, I think we need to or had to use that money because of what's happened in their lives. We have to consider the level of contributions to the funds. And what we have seen as part of the COVID-19 experience is that there have been a lot of employers experiencing financial distress. So even the level of contribution has been reduced. So it means that members now need to start building up their contributions into the future to try and make up any shortfalls that they've experienced. So how do I invest my money? Is there capacity in my retirement fund or my future retirement fund to make additional voluntary contributions, to change my contribution category so that I can start contributing at a higher level? Or alternatively, you know, if I can't get back into the working environment, is there an opportunity for me to start a tax-free savings account or to start looking at a retirement annuity just to get that savings process going while I'm finding my feet? The investment strategy is also key for members in terms of you have no control of whether you're going to have negative performance or positive performance. So I think that is something that you have to base on your long-term plan. So if you're younger, time is on your side and you definitely have more opportunity to invest more aggressively to try and make up any losses and then also expenses. So there's certain things that are out of members' controls. They do have risk benefits, so death, disability and other expenses in terms of the retirement fund that impacts that net allocation to savings. So measuring that, you know, how can I... is there anything that I can do there in terms of my flexible risk? Can I reduce that saving or can I reduce those costs relative to what is being spent and relative to my needs? And then also to look at normal retirement age. And I think we touched on earlier that people are living longer. So is 65 still a relevant retirement age? Although on average in the stats, we see that people are going off earlier and our actual average retirement age is 61.5 years. So it becomes a bit difficult to say to your employer, well, I actually want to stay on till I'm 70, but you are limited to working to 65. So members need to look at ways, you know, if they haven't preserved or if they can preserve through their funding, keep that money as to build on that as best they can with the resources that they have. We know it's an emotional journey at the moment for people in retirement funds.
But the power of compounding, Belinda, I just want to touch on information that from the survey, looking at the impact of retiring at various ages really is quite illustrative because deciding to retire at the age of 65 rather than 55 can double a member's net replacement ratio. So if you start to add one or 2 years onto that, you really have a significant compounding effect. But Andrew, I want to come back to one of the interesting observations around preservation, or rather the lack thereof, that came through the survey. And it seemed to me the more you have in your retirement pot, the more likely you are to preserve. And the less you have in that pot, the more likely you are to say, well, it's a smaller amount, I'm going to cash it in. Doesn't that mean the industry now really has some targeted information to know who they need to be counseling when it comes to this issue of preservation and really channeling all of your resources into those individuals who may have smaller amounts or maybe early on in their retirement journeys? And back to Belinda's point, if you're younger, you think, well, I can cash it in because I've got a long road to make it up. But it's decisions you actually make in your 20s and 30s that can have these compounded benefits into the future. It's a cohort or a demographic that really we struggle to get to think seriously about retirement. Why is it? Why is it that it's only once you hit 40 and you've got the kids and the car and all of those other responsibilities that you start taking retirement seriously?
Yeah. So, I mean, you're right. I think that's a big challenge, is that youngsters tend to think retirement is a problem they can deal with at a later stage. And I think, you know, one of the problems with cashing in small amounts is that a whole lot of small amounts obviously become a big amount unless you cash them in and you don't give them any chance to grow. So there is this perception that it's only a small amount. You know, I've got those needs that are much more immediate. Let me rather just use it, even if it's to pay off debt, you know, which seems like a good idea. But the problem is, if you've got your eye on the retirement fund to get rid of some of your debt every few years when you change jobs, you're never giving it a chance to grow into anything decent, you know. And to the point that Belinda made about playing catch up, is if you are going to use it and convince yourself that paying off debt is a good idea using your retirement savings, that's fine. But then you've got to now contribute even more to close the gap on your retirement plan. And those are the sorts of decisions that are dangerous, you know. And 20-year-olds, I mean, our stats are similar to the Forbes stats from an Old Mutual point of view. 90% plus of the assets that 20-year-olds build up just flow straight back out the system as soon as people change jobs. And of course, the other problem in the current working world is that people do change jobs more frequently than they did when Dave was still a young man, you know?
Thank you very much.
as a result, you know, the savings never build up. And I think there's another factor, is that when your savings look bigger, you probably are more inclined to rather leave them because they look, you know, it feels like a more significant act to raid a big amount, whereas who cares? It's not really much anyway. So I'll take it. But as I say, if you do that too frequently, you never get a big amount.
Mm-hmm. There's potentially some tweaking of the defaults here in terms of our behavioral economic insights into this, into how we can nudge people into making better choices. But Dave, we're running out of time. You've developed through your career the Crawford model, as you're calling it now, which really, I think, is a fantastic tool that allows you to tweak a few, slide a few things around, and really helps you understand whether or not you're on the right path or on the right road. Just share with me how the Crawford measure works.
Okay, very, very briefly, what I've done is to look at, and this thing's about 10, I've started with it about 10 years ago, resulting from questions from individuals on courses. And the biggest question was always, am I saving enough? And the question is, what is enough? So to examine enough, what I did was to take salaries and work out a living standard. And coincidentally, and Andrew actually pointed it out to me, I was doing something very similar to what the head of actuarial at Cape Town University was doing, Jola Goodko. And she and I verified each other's work. We were both quite thrilled to find that somebody else had arrived at the same conclusion. Basically, your living standard is your income minus what you save. And in the case of the work we do, minus tax, because we want to give people, show people an after-tax living standard. We compare that to what they would have if they retired today. Doesn't matter what age. And we use an annuity rate of 4.5%, take the tax off, and we express a ratio. So if you are, let's say, 35, your ratio might be pretty low. But I've always had this problem with future values, because I was legal in general when the whole crisis of over those huge illustrative values came up, and there was a gigantic mess, a lot of very unhappy people. So I haven't liked that. So let's assume our 30-year-old has got a, let's say, a 20% ratio. I reckoned that instead of looking at how many, you know, the rule of 300 and all those things, instead of looking at those, why don't we say, how do we get from 30% to 100% over the remaining years? So if we escalate the percentage, next year it'll be 36, 37. So you've got to redo that calculation every year, and you've got to put everything into it. And Belinda, I mean, I wanted to shout hallelujah, hallelujah when you talk about it, because most people do not understand, for example, the 27.5% rule, because they don't really know what should be counted for that. Okay? So we can tidy all that up and give it to people. But what we also show, Michael, is that when we look at how much those percentages must grow on the way, because remember, your capital's got to grow at a faster rate than your living standard grows, otherwise you can't improve the ratio. Okay, so when we do that, what we produce is the real return that's needed, the average real return for the term. So if your real return is over 4%, that clearly indicates that you're probably not saving enough. Because if you take 4%, add, let's say, inflation at 6 and costs at 2. I looked at the figures on the member watch and came up with around about 3. So, but let's say 2. That means you've got to earn 12%. Every year, like clockwork, from now to retirement, and you may not be able to do it. Yeah. So if you save more, you improve the ratio, you reduce however slightly the real return you need, and you can watch it regularly. And most people can do it by themselves.
That's the beauty of it. I think it sounds so simple when you put it into those very simple and easy to understand terms. There's a lot that goes on behind it as well. But I think what it boils down to is education, is getting this knowledge, this power into the hands of the individual members at the end of the day. And unfortunately, that's all the time we have for today. I do think that the COVID-19 crisis perhaps will accelerate that thinking, because it's given a lot of people who are now either being retrenched or facing a potential retrenchment an idea of what an unplanned retirement might look like. So perhaps this is the time to really bring home that point and stress that to members as well. Thank you very much to Belinda Sullivan, Principal Consultant of Multinational Consulting and Best Practice at Alex Forbes, Andrew Davison, Head of Advice at Old Mutual Corporate Consultants, and Dave Crawford, Founder of Planning Retirement.